Now, Wendy, would you read Psalm 113? Two psalms that we're going to read. The psalms are an absolute brilliant resource. You know, one of the reformers, John Calvin, said that when you look at the book of Psalms, you see reflected as in a mirror, every human experience. And that's what you, and the Psalms are a great source of comfort. I think one of the exciting things about the Psalms is to remember why God gave them to us. In one sense, he gave them to us. You know, Jesus said the Psalms pointed to him. So you read emotions that he felt. But also, they were given to God's people to be prayed. And often you'll see when you read the Psalms that the complaints are very general. You know, they don't name the enemies or the troubles. And I think that's done on purpose so that we can apply our own situation into them. And when you read the depression or the stress or the anxiety in the Psalms, you're being reminded that we've got a God who gives us words to put on our lips that express these emotions, which means that he can handle these emotions and he can handle these questions and he can handle our doubts and our sorrows. And it's not unspiritual to feel these feelings. So Psalm 13, notice in Psalm 13, it goes four verses of sorrow and then there's a breakthrough to joy. And I think there's a variety of suggestions as to why this is. I think the reality is that as we bring ourselves to God, sometimes an unexplainable comfort comes. But just in case you think that that is too simplistic, the second psalm will be Psalm 88. And Psalm 88 has no joy. Psalm 88 finishes saying, "Darkness is my closest friend." Haunting the end, "The darkness is my closest friend." I read a book, it was a book of two halves. I read this book and I can't remember the name of the person who wrote it. It was a double-barreled name that she had. But she called it "Darkness is my closest friend." I'm OCD, so I'm a little bit odd. But I rate the books that I read during the year. You know, and this was a book that the first half was 5-star and the second half was 3-star. And the first half was all about her experience of depression and going into care and the effect that had on her family and on her own self-esteem, you know, that she had going through that and seeing the pain that it brought to her family. I thought I'd begin by telling my own story. As I say, I'm no expert. I'm just speaking out of personal experience. And, you know, you read a couple of books and then you present yourself as an expert. But when I was about 19, I started to suffer a little bit of stress. I remember I was young, very young in the faith. And I remember being very insecure about my relationship with God. And I remember thinking I committed the unforgivable sin, you know. And I should say to you, if you've ever worried about that, you haven't. Because it's a description of a condition where you're impervious to any desire for Jesus. But I was convinced I'd done this even before I could think what I had done to do it. And it was probably just my nerves getting at me. That passed, and then a couple of years later, anxiety came back to me with a vengeance for just about a month or 6 weeks. And I remember it was summertime. I was in college. I was staying at my sister's house in Dublin. And I remember being in the bus and being so anxious that I would be shaking. You know, I'd go into my uncle's house, and when everyone left the room, just lying on the floor because my stomach was churning so much that it was just trying to get some comfort. And I suppose at that stage, not terribly seriously, but I would have felt a little bit suicidal. And then it sort of went away for a while, but I was always vulnerable to stress, vulnerable to anxiety coming back, vulnerable to deep levels of insecurity. And then when I was about 30, I'm 42, so this is about 12 years ago. When I was 30, the nature of my anxiety began to change. I passed through, I would say I struggled more with anxiety than depression, but they're very related. And I passed through times which would be more classically depressed. So I remember one time going home to my parents who were living in Killarney, and I'd lost a lot of weight. And I was only because I couldn't eat, you know. And my mum saying, oh, you look fantastic. And I thought, well, there's an inverse proportional relationship to how well I look on the outside, having lost all this weight, and what I'm feeling on the inside, which is just that I couldn't face food. I was waking up early in the morning and unable to get back to sleep, and having that feeling, maybe you've had it where you wake up and you just hope that the feeling of emptiness is gone. But when I was about 30, it began to change. And it began to be these sort of intrusive thoughts that would come into my mind. And I would struggle to keep them out of my head. And what they're called are anti-thoughts, which is basically you're thinking about the things you don't want to think about. We all do it on some level. You know, our minds are very active. But these just were obsessive. I couldn't keep them out of my mind. And I developed all these sort of physical symptoms to try and, or physical tics to try and overcome my thoughts. So, for example, I used to put my finger like that underneath my wedding ring. And that was my way of saying, I don't like this thought in my head, because I realized it was easier to control your body than it was to control your mind. But, of course, these got sort of out of control in some ways. I'd be fidgeting the whole time. I remember someone came to me to talk about a wedding, and they must have thought I was complete idiot, because I said to them, I said, Leslie, you just sit there over there, and I'm going to lie down and listen to you, even though we're in my front sitting room, because I just couldn't. I was just so awkward. And so I just thought it was the way I was. And one of the things, like, if there's a number of things I want you to hear in this talk. One of the things is go quickly to see a doctor. Go quickly to see a doctor. Because I've talked to people about OCD-related things and so on. And people are reluctant to go to the doctor. I was reluctant to go to the doctor because I just thought this was the way I was. I just thought, look, I'm a worrier. It's just the way I'm made. There's nothing particular about it. But a key moment occurred to me when my dad was 75. My dad was 75. We went to Tipperary. And as a family, we went up to, we rented a cottage. And we were sitting around talking. And my mum mentioned my dad's mum. And she said, my dad's mum had spent a lot of time in care for mental health related issues. And it was then that I thought, maybe this is medical. You know, maybe this isn't just me being silly. Maybe this isn't just that I'm insecure. There might be something more to this. And I kind of looked for my wife to give me permission to go to the doctor. I wasn't very good at going to the doctor. And I was waiting for her to prompt me and say, go. And in the kindness of God, there were two GPs in the church and a psychiatrist. This is the church that Michael grew up in. And I eventually went to the doctor when I just was beginning to get, I would say, a little bit socially awkward. I know the psychiatrist said at that stage, I looked a little bit like I had Tourette's because I would mumble so much. And I went to Rosie, and Rosie immediately said, look, take some Valium, go home. And I went home. And that night, Stephen, the psychiatrist, came out and saw me. And he said to me, he said, having heard my description of the way my thoughts were working and how I was dealing with them, he said, your thoughts are repulsive to you. They're repetitive, they're resistant, and they're ridiculous. And they are, you know, the funny thing about OCD as an illness is it's a very embarrassing illness because some of the things that you worry about are so illogical to anybody else, but they're very real worries to you. And he said, you've got OCD, he says, and he gave me tablets. I'm still on those tablets now, 10 years later or whatever it is, that I highly recommend medication in the right environment and so on. He put me in a treatment called cognitive behavior therapy, which helps you process your thoughts and understand the nature with which you think. And he gave me 2 months off straight away. I tell you that story just to put you in the picture. And in some ways, I suppose, because we need to talk about these things, because one of the problems with mental health is the stigma that goes around it. I remember Stephen said to me, he said, when I give you a prescription, he says, you know, you're a minister in this town, it's a small village of 3,000 people, why don't you get your prescription and pour it down up the road rather than getting your prescription, because people will talk. Now, they were going to talk anyway, because I was going to have to take 2 months off work. So, but I decided, actually, you know, I think it's better to be open about these things. It's better to put it out there, you know, and I've had nothing but support from people, you know, as a result. What I'm thinking about today is depression and its related anxiety from a Christian perspective, looking at its causes and its cures. And then also looking about how, as a church community, do we help people who are going through depression and anxiety. And then I'll try to be as quick as possible so then we can chip in together and chat. But on the screen, Simon, does that come up? Oh, don't worry. Well, I'll just start off. First question, what causes depression? I must admit, and I'd be interested if some of you have read helpful books, because I find it hard to find a really good book on depression. Every book, and maybe it's my own bias coming in, when it comes from Christian books, I think sometimes the books don't put enough emphasis on the medical side of depression. I think other books, I found it hard to find the ideal book on depression. But one book by a guy called Ed Welch called Depression, he says, depression is a form of suffering that can't be reduced to one individual cause. Many factors cause depression. And often more than one of these factors is at work in a person at any given time. So you might find, and I would find this with myself, that there's a mixture of things that have gone into my mind in terms of the way I've been thought to think, things in my worldview that might be unhelpful, but there's also, I believe, chemical imbalances in the brain and so on that contribute. And these things work together. So depression is in some ways multifaceted, which means that when it comes to helping people with depression, we have to realize that we're dealing with something that's complex. And one of the things that I've done is, from a biblical perspective, try to think, well, what are some of the factors that cause depression? So I started with other people. About half of the Psalms talk about enemies, people who are giving the psalmist a hard time. And other people cause us to experience sorrow and anxiety in life. You know, this is probably most dramatically seen if you have friends who are being abused. You know, that the scars that are brought there will come back later on in life. People who are being bullied in school often struggle later on in life with the pain that that caused them. People whose parents have given them input that's being negative can affect people later on in life. And the psalmist reflects that in about half the psalms, this mention of enemies, people who have caused the psalmist to feel great levels of sorrow. Another factor that causes depression is the fact that we live in a fallen world. You know, you go back to the book of Genesis in the early chapters, and initially creation, it's pronounced this is good, and the human experience is good and without death. And then you have the fall, where humankind rebel against God. They say, we won't let God tell us what is good and evil. We'll rival God. You remember Satan comes and he says, if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will be like God. So it's about throwing off his rule. It's an act of treason. And the judgment in that is the fall, that we live in a world characterized by decay and death. And it affects people right across the human spectrum. So you have physical illnesses in our world, but you also have mental illnesses in our world. You have a physical effect on our body that can cause mental anxiety, like a low thyroid or chemical imbalances in the brain. And this is a part of living in a fallen world. Then there is the fact that we ourselves contribute to our own depression at times. You know, if you are a person who won't let go of anger, if you're bitter, if you allow jealousy rule your life, or you're judgmental, it will affect your mood. False beliefs. False beliefs are a factor in our depression. And that can come from your parents. Maybe, you know, I can think of people who have grown up with parents who have always given them a negative feeling about themselves, or put a standard that they could never reach. And as a result, they've struggled to feel levels of security. But it can be also feelings about God. I quite like Martin Luther, you know, the reformer. But Martin Luther had a terrible picture of God before he had a breakthrough theologically. He used to be terrified of God. He was in a theological college, and there was a statue of Jesus, and there was a sword going through his mouth. And he could say he used to not be able to look at that for fear that it would bring up, because to him, God was just wanting to catch him out. And he suffered depression right throughout his life. He called it Anfechtung, which is a German word, and I'm sure I've pronounced that right, but I'm thinking none of you know German particularly well anyway. But I'm sure, and anyway, I realize I probably actually, sure, do you teach German? No, you don't?
No.
No, just in case. No, you're a doctor, so yeah, but anyway. But someone here is going to know that I'm pronouncing this wrong. But it was always, his depression always had the same effect on him, which was to question whether God was good and whether he's good to me. Then the devil causes depression. I don't mean that in a wacky sense, you know, but remember that he's the accuser. He'll remind you of your past. He'll remind you of your guilt. He'll try to put a wedge between you. You go back to the Garden of Eden, and what does he do? He tries to sow doubt in your mind about the goodness of the character of God. Psalm 32 is an interesting psalm. It's a great psalm of forgiveness. But David in Psalm 32 talks about the sorrow that he felt in his heart when he was denying his sin with Bathsheba, and how he was never at rest. And it suggests that there's an element sometimes where God uses depression as a way of bringing us back to himself, as he does a whole variety of factors. But be very careful about that. Never, ever, ever assume that the reason someone's going through a hard time is because of something they've done. You know, that's really bad theology and very insensitive. And there is a sense in which God is behind our depression and anxiety, because God's in control of the universe. And that to me is a great comfort. You know, people may have said things in your past that caused you wounds, and you might struggle with why God allowed that happen. But underneath there's that thankfulness that, you know what, God was never off his throne. You know, he never let me out to the wolves. And as much as the sovereignty of God, the control of God over his universe might raise awkward questions for us, ultimately it's a comfort to us that our God is in control. So depression has multiple causes, and as a result there's multiple solutions. One of the questions that I've thought about depression, and I've got about 6 points. I don't think they're going to come up, are they? Don't worry about it. I've got about 6 points. That was the longest point, by the way, or one of the longest, right? But one of the questions when it came to talking about depression that I wanted to wrestle with is it unspiritual to be depressed? After all, the fruit of the Holy Spirit includes joy. So when you're depressed, are you somehow less spiritual because you're not displaying, in an obvious sense, that joy? Before I answer that question, I don't think it's unspiritual to be depressed. One of the reasons I don't think it's unspiritual to be depressed is because if you look at the history of the church, you'll see many very godly people who struggled with depression throughout their life. One of them was C.H. Spurgeon. He was a preacher in London in the late 1800s. And one time he was preaching in a place called the Exeter Hall. There was 12,000 people there. And in the middle of that hall, someone stood up and shouted, "Fire!" And there was a stampede. 7 people were killed. He was inconsolable. It was something that came back to haunt him again and again in his life. But there were other factors that led Spurgeon to struggle with depression. He had gout, and the physical suffering that caused him would get him down. There was the fact that, and I think it was his wife who said this, that Spurgeon had a great ability to listen and care about people's problems, but he didn't have an ability to share his own struggles with other people. And keeping those things into himself affected his mood. Spurgeon one time said, he said, there are dungeons beneath the castle of despair, and I've been in them. Or he said at one stage, he said of a time that he went through depression, he said, I could have wept by the hour like a child, and yet I did not know what I wept for. Then another area where we see spiritual people struggle with depression is in the book of Psalms. Psalm 88, there's no hope in it. But the Psalms are full of reality. I remember the first time I came across Psalm 13. It was the first church I worked in, and I was very wet behind the ears. And there was a girl who had gone into hospital, and she was having terrible problems with her pregnancy. She was leaking fluid, and it looked like the baby wouldn't survive. And I didn't know what to do. But I decided I should go in every day to see her, because I thought if this ends up as badly as it's supposed to end up, she's going to need someone she's familiar with. And I remember hearing Psalm 13 on the radio, and I just remember being struck by its raw honesty. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? You know, have you turned your face away from me? And I love that raw honesty, and I shared it with her. I don't even know what I said. And actually later she wrote back to me. Her situation actually worked out well, but she wrote to me a year later when I'd left the church, and she said she still remembered that psalm. You know, she looked back in that time. And I think the thing that had resonated with her was it wasn't a platitude. You know, to hear these psalmists question God. Sometimes they talk to God with an honesty, a rawness that is awkward for our ears to hear. You know, we wonder, well, where can we draw the line? One of the psalms, he says, you know, I'm going to put my hand over my mouth just in case I keep on speaking, you know. But actually, the psalms are full of raw honesty and questions. And when you're depressed, you know, one of the things to do is to turn to the psalms. Of course, the hard thing is when you're depressed, it's really hard to pray. And one of the things to do is get other people to pray for you. Because we believe prayer matters. Prayer changes things. So the Psalms show spiritual people going through times of depression. But think about Jesus. Isaiah chapter 53. Jesus was a man of sorrows, familiar with grief. Spurgeon said about Jesus, he said, there is not necessarily sin connected with our sorrow of heart. For Jesus Christ, our Lord, once said, my soul is sorrowful even to the point of death, and there is no sin in him, so consequently no sin in his sorrow. But one thing just to say before I move on, do be careful. In your depression, do not sin. In the sense that depression does present us with temptations. There's temptations towards self-pity. It's very hard when you're depressed and not to turn in on yourself. There's a temptation towards false comfort, whether in alcohol or food or overwork. So be careful in your depression, but do not think that your depression makes you less spiritual. But then what about the fact that the fruit of the Spirit includes joy? Well, what I do whenever I reach a roadblock is I've got this friend in Australia, and he's a lecturer in a theological college, and he's really bright. And I just pawn off my difficult questions to him. I was saying to someone outside, you know, the questions I don't answer are the ones in the Trinity. You know, my 8-year-old son loves to ask questions of the Trinity. I'll answer the facts of life, but not the Trinity. You know, it's just too complicated. Well, I do this to Peter. He's a lecturer in this theological college in Sydney. So he's one of the brightest people I've ever met. So I wrote to him and I said, well, how do you square the fact that on one hand it's not unspiritual to be depressed, but the fruit of the Spirit is joy? How do we put these two things together? And he started his email back to me with these terrible words. He said, good question. I didn't want him to say good question. I wanted a simple answer to this. You know, good question suggests it's not going to be straightforward. But he said this. He says, I guess that joy is not simply an emotion. Joy is not simply an emotion. So someone can have joy, though it is harder, in the terms of being confident in the character of God or being confident in God, trusting God in the midst of their depression. Maybe that sounds a bit simplistic, but listen to Psalm 31. Psalm 31, verse 8 and 9, gets this, or 7 to 9. Because listen to Psalm 31. It talks about joy, but it talks about sorrow at the same time. And the joy is clearly not, you know, a happy sort of light-hearted spirit. The joy is a trust in God in the midst of the pain. And this exists at the same time he's feeling the pain. So it says this, I will be glad and rejoice in the Lord, for you saw my affliction and you knew the anguish of my heart. Well, if you had that verse on your own, you'd think to yourself that the reason that he feels joy is that he's being delivered. But it's not that case. You have not handed me over to the enemy, but you have set my feet in spacious places. But listen to verse 9. Be merciful to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eyes flow weak with sorrow, my soul and body with grief. He hasn't been delivered. He's still in the midst of his sorrow. And there can be, although it is hard, a deep-rooted confidence in the character of God, or a feeling that I am being held in the midst of this, even in the midst of absolute and real sorrow. So Ed Welch says this, joy is not the opposite of depression. Joy is deeper than depression, and you can experience both. Becoming a Christian does not make you immune from sorrow, but you do have the comfort, even if you don't feel it, of knowing that you're held in the right hand of God. Joan Singleton, I'm sure most of you, or many of you might know her. She is the pastoral care person in Irish Bible Institute. And she was coming down to our church and she spoke a little bit about depression. And she told a little bit about her own story. And she said that she was suffering from very bad depression. I think it was postnatal depression. And she began to struggle. You know, what does this say about my faith? How does this affect my witness? And then she had a thought that she believed was from God. And that is that there's testimony in the fact that she's holding on in the midst of the sorrow. The very fact that she's keeping on going in the midst of her pain, though she may not have superficial happiness, that is testimony in itself to God at work within her. Similar thought, and maybe I'm just getting a little bit pernickety about these things, but what about anxiety? You know, Jesus says a lot of times, don't worry. Well, I don't know about you, but if you're burnt out, if you've got an anxiety-related disorder, it seems a little bit superficial to be told to stop worrying. I know a friend of mine who went through a time of depression and burnout, and he was very tired with people coming to him. One person gave him a book that had a chapter about not worrying. I thought it was only so easy. Well, now this is where you need to concentrate a little bit. I think there's a parallel between how worry is dealt with and doubt is dealt with. Because in the New Testament, there seems to be a type of doubt that is culpable and a type of doubt that's not culpable. A type of doubt that receives a rebuke and a type of doubt that doesn't receive a rebuke. So, for example, there are many situations where Jesus has shown himself to act with undeniable power, and the disciples still doubt. So what does he say to Thomas? He says, stop doubting and believe. But then you go to the book of Jude, and in the book of Jude, this is what we're told. Be gentle with those who doubt. Not rebuke them, but be gentle to them. Why is that? Well, because in the book of Jude, what seems to have happened is that false teachers came into the church, upset what the people believed, sowed confusion, and the people were doubting. It wasn't because they didn't have trust in God. It wasn't a moral issue. And so the response to it is not to rebuke them and say, stop doubting and believe, but be gentle towards those who doubt. And I think something similar happens with worry. That there's a culpable worry. So, for example, if your worries are built around the fact that you have built your life around your image, or things that can easily be taken off you, and if you have seen God faithfully work in the past but refuse to trust him in the present, Jesus will probably say to you, stop worrying. But I know that when you're burnt out, when you are suffering from an anxiety-related disorder, what they used to call up the north and the rural areas, they'd say, so-and-so, she suffers with her nerves. I know that that woman doesn't need to be told, stop worrying. She needs gentleness and understanding. She may need the help of professionals. Because her worry isn't about a lack of faith. Her worry is related to how she's wired. Or maybe burnout. There may be physical reasons. I know with my own OCD, sometimes my worries are based around things that just don't make any cognitive sense. Because they're not based on a lack of trust in God. So be very gentle with people who are worrying. Because sometimes that worry is more of a physical burnout, a stress-related thing, maybe a problem in wiring of the brain or whatever, that needs a gentle touch, not just simply be told, stop worrying. What about antidepressants? John Piper is a pastor in America, and I was watching his podcast, and this girl had written into him, and she put this question to him. She said, I'm a Christian, and I take antidepressants. Is that okay? Because people tell me I'm not trusting God. And what he does is he gets a bottle of water, and he took a sip, and he put down the bottle of water, and he said, was that a lack of trust in God? He said, my throat was dry. I suppose I could have prayed and said, Lord, could you moisten my throat, please? But instead I took a glass of water. Was that a lack of trust in God? And he says he believed that something similar is the truth with antidepressants. That he's come to the conclusion that there are many physical elements, medical elements, in many people's stress and anxiety. And because there's a medical element, just like you would take a medicine for any other physical related illness, that it is not unspiritual to take tablets. And I know that for myself, that, you know, I every now and then I try to, and it's a real numpty thing to do, I try to break taking my tablets, you know. I'll say to Caroline, it happened a few years ago, I said, Caroline, I've done it. I said, I don't need them anymore. 2 days later, I had a complete meltdown. I need my tablets. Because the way my brain is, maybe there's anything unspiritual about that. You know, I would encourage any of you who's suffering from stress and anxiety, go to your doctor. Get help. You know, talk. And that leads us on to the fifth out of six, so we're nearly there. How do you deal with depression? One of the things that I would say about depression is faith in Jesus is wonderful. Do you remember the atheists in England, the British Humanist Association had a sign on the buses? It said, God probably doesn't exist, so stop worrying and get on with enjoying life. Something like that. A lot of us were glad that it said probably, you know. But that's not the only reason that ad campaign was mistaken. Andrew Sims was a president of the Royal College of Psychiatry. And this is what he said. He said, the advantageous effect of religious belief and spirituality on mental and physical health is one of the best kept secrets in medicine and psychiatry in particular. The reality is that mental health-wise, faith is a good thing. Faith is something that brings us comfort. And I don't want you to think that I'm just saying have any old faith. I believe that Christianity is uniquely true, and I believe that Christianity is uniquely good for your mental health. You think about it, compare the gospel of grace that we thought about this morning with the world's teaching on self-esteem. You remember that song, Search for the Hero Inside Yourself? Yeah, that's the world's culture of self-esteem. Have you ever tried to search for the hero inside yourself? You know, if I look inside myself, I don't find a hero. I find a people pleaser, a coward. I find a pathetic person who's obsessed with what people think of him. I find someone who can be pushed along to the crowd one way or the other. I don't find a hero inside myself. If you're going to tell me that the way to deal with my mental thinking in a way that will help my mental health is self-esteem, I'm always going to be insecure because I'm having to deny certain things that I see within me. But you take the gospel of grace, that God made you in his image, that he's placed eternity in your heart, that you have a unique value because you are unique to him, that he can look inside you and not see a hero, but he loves you anyway. That he sees you as being worse than you even realize yourself, but he loves you more than you'll ever love yourself. That you have a security, that nothing can remove you from his grip, that nothing can separate you from his love. That he goes on, you know, 1 John, it says, the blood of Christ goes on cleansing us from all sin. You're not just forgiven what you did in the past, you're forgiven the things you do today and tomorrow and the day after. That's a much better message for your mental health than any self-esteem talk. Grow in the confidence and the character of God is my second thing. I know that for me, one of the things that caused me anxiety, it was one of the factors that caused an insecure person like myself trouble, was the problems I had grasping the grace and kindness of God. Grow in your confidence in the character of God. Sometimes, and particularly when you're depressed or anxious, it's time for simple theology. It's time for looking at the person of Jesus and meditating upon his grace. It's not a time to get into, you know, your most difficult texts in the Bible. It's time for trying to just focus on the beauty of the person revealed in Jesus. Examine yourself. Maybe God is using the dryness you feel to cause you to depend on him. Look after your body. John Piper said that one of the things that helped him in his low mood was to jog every day. Paul says to Timothy, there's some value in physical exercise. Pray the Psalms. You know, take a psalm like Psalm 13 and put it on your own lips. And if you can't get very far into that psalm, don't beat yourself up. If you can't concentrate, because I know that when I was particularly ill, I couldn't concentrate in anything. I like to read, but I couldn't concentrate in books. There was quite a period of time I just couldn't read any books. I just couldn't settle my mind to take anything in. It's the same with prayer. And I was talking to a friend of mine last week, and she was saying, you know, one of the difficult things for her in the crisis that she's facing at the moment is that in some ways she always thought that, you know, the crisis would cause you to lean God harder, but it just seems that he's further away. Get people to pray for you. Get people to pray with you. And pray the Psalms and talk. We have a fantastic guy in our church, Elijah Chyla. He's a neurologist. He's a lovely, lovely man. And I spoke in depression, and then I asked Elijah to come with his knowledge of the brain and to answer questions. But his big thing was talk. You know, don't keep it to yourself. I'm surprised when I look back on the early days of my anxiety, how few people I spoke to. And because by nature I'm a bit of a blabbermouth, but actually I kept it to myself. I don't know why. And then finally, what does the church do to help? Well, one woman writing about her own depression, she's not a Christian, but she was writing this. She said, when I was struggling with my own depression, she's a psychiatrist, the most healing moments came when someone I love simply sat with me as I cried and wordlessly held my hand and spoke warmly to me. Be there. Psalm and a Proverb 17, verse 17 says, a friend loves at all time, and a brother is born for a time of adversity. And another thing that I found, I think it was on the web, small gestures help. You know, if you know someone who's got children, and they're going through times of depression, you know, to babysit for a night, make a meal. You know, those sort of things help. Sometimes the things that don't help, and I know this has been recorded, but I don't think the guy will ever find out, but I got up in church when I had to take my 2 months off, and I remember I said, I'm going to preach every week, but I'm going to disappear for coffee time, and don't feel you need to visit. In fact, please don't visit. I just need some space. Of course, someone had to come and sit in my house for an hour. You know, just I think it was just to get the the feeling that they'd done something. I ended up making conversation with this person for an hour in my house because they felt guilty about not doing anything, about me being depressed, and they just making me feel worse. But small gestures help. Write a card. Send a text. Be careful about Bible verses. A friend of mine, she had a nervous breakdown. And she said to me, she said, you know, I'm really sick of people coming up to me and telling me God works all things together for the good of those who love him. Yeah, it doesn't feel like that at the moment. And the reality, you see, the problem with Bible verses is, one, learn your theology during the good times so that it's there during the bad times, so that it's deep down in your heart. She knew that verse. No one needed to remind her of the verse, but it felt like what they were doing was coming up to her and pawning her off. You know, getting it again, getting it off their conscience. I fired a verse at them, they'll be okay. And it was very insensitive. It suggested that they weren't willing to get into the mess of her problems. The other thing is, don't say, I know how you feel. We had someone in the last church that I worked in, and they came to me and they said, I'm really tired of people telling me they know how I feel. They don't know how I feel. And the reality is that even if you have struggled with depression, you don't necessarily know how another person's depression is affecting them. You might have, for example, postnatal depression, but that doesn't mean you're an expert on how the postnatal depression is affecting your friend. And they don't necessarily want you to sit down and tell you, you know, for you to tell them how miserable it was for you. And I got their pastoral care team together and I said, okay, guys, I said, I want you to say the following words. I said, I want you to say, I know how you feel. And they all said, I know how you feel. And I said, let that be the last time you ever say that phrase in the pastoral care of this church. Doesn't help. Obviously, don't say snap out of it. You know, should go without saying. And two last things. Model the kindness of God. One of the most helpful things when someone is, because when we struggle with depression, we're prone to believing lies. When you're just struggling with anxiety, you're prone to doubt the character of God. The truth sometimes has a harder time getting to you. And one of the ways that we help other people is to model the kindness of God. So there was a minister I knew, his name was George Good, very godly man. And I've read a couple of books by a guy called Ajit Fernando, who knew George Good. And this is what he said in the start of a couple of his books. He says, to the pastor of my teenage years, which was George Good, who influenced me in the beauty of godliness. And I know, because Uncle George was my Uncle George, not, you know, he's one of those not related uncles. And I saw the way he was. When you met George, there was something that said, God is good. Because if God made people to love him, and to love him meant that they turned out like George, George's very presence reminded you of the goodness of God. It's one of the ways we minister to each other. And finally, Tim Keller, he talks about in a book, I've forgotten which book it is. Oh, actually, I found it something related to another book, but anyway, someone quoted Keller. And he said, Keller said, our churches should not be like the waiting rooms to job interviews, but the waiting rooms to go see the doctor. You know, when you go to a waiting room to a job interview, you're putting out an image of yourself. You're strong. But if you sat in the emergency room, there's no place for pride, no place for pretense. You admit you're weak. And our churches need to be like that. They need to be places where we're honest and vulnerable with each other. In fact, there's a TED Talk. You know TED Talks? There's a TED Talk in vulnerability. It was excellent. I should tell you, I'm running out of time, but I can tell you one quick story. There's a TED Talk about honesty. And the woman says, we're all liars at heart. And she says, there was this gorilla that they got. And they taught this gorilla sign language. And then they gave him a kitten. And they put him in a room. And they went into the room one day and the sink has been pulled out of the wall. And what do? They walk into the room and what does the gorilla do? He blamed the kitten. But we're by nature. But anyway, that's nothing to do with anything. Let me finish. I hope this doesn't sound insensitive, right? I would never want to go through some of the times I've gone through. And I'm not sure I would say this to myself if I could talk to myself when I was going through the worst times. But with hindsight, there's a part of me that knows I learned things from going through the times I went through. And I'm not saying that you pass through depression and you'll ever come to a stage in this life where you'll know where God was at. And I'm certainly not going to go up to someone who's depressed and say, don't worry, God will use it for good. But there is a sense, I think, that sometimes we can look back and we can see that God did use that to teach us things about himself and to grow us. And Psalm 119 says this, it was good for me to be afflicted so I might learn your decrees. Or the Bible translator J.B. Phillips says this, these periods of spiritual dryness, which every saint has known, are the very times where your need of God is greatest. So worship him, remembering that it may or may not bring back the feelings, but your contact with God in prayer and praise will strengthen you spiritually, whether you feel it or not. Time of spiritual apathy are the very times where we can do most to prove our love for God, and I have no doubt we bring him most joy to his heart when we defy our feelings and act in spite of them. My hope is that for you guys, as you go through times of sorrow and anxiety, that there would come a day in this life that you'd be able to look back and say, you know, I'd never go through that again, but God did teach me some things about him through that. Well, why don't we let you out, because I've kept it the hour. And if anyone else wants to talk to me, they can stay behind. They can stay behind after the class.